This is special coverage of the Salt Lake City mayoral race from 45 Days, KUER's political podcast. I'm Nicole Nixon. This November, Salt Lake City voters will elect a new mayor. The seat is open following current mayor Jackie Biskupski's decision not to seek re-election. City Councilwoman Erin Mendenhall and State Senator Luz Escamilla are each campaigning for the opportunity to lead the city for the next 4 years. This week, we sat down with both candidates over two consecutive evenings at the business incubator Church and State in downtown Salt Lake City in front of a live audience. This is our full interview with Erin Mendenhall. She's served on the city council for 6 years and represents the Liberty Wells, Ballpark, and 9th and 9th neighborhoods. She also co-founded the clean air advocacy group Breathe Utah. So I'm going to start just by asking kind of a ubiquitous question we ask around here. Are you from Salt Lake City?
I say I am. I moved to Salt Lake Valley as a seven-year-old girl. I ended up moving to 9th and 9th 2 days after I graduated from high school, and I've lived in basically a one-mile radius around the 9th and 9th neighborhood for the last 22 or so years.
So what made you get started in local politics?
I grew up with a mom who calls herself a hippie and a father who passed away when I was a young teenager. And so I think in a lot of ways I grew up fast, but I also grew up feeling like I could protest, I could attend rallies, and I could have my voice heard. But when it came down to it, I was a young 20-year-old learning about how very deeply environmental policy ends up impacting our lives at the family level, up through the community, even our nation. And things that we thought were safe a long time ago, of course, we know today were catastrophic or carcinogenic. And it piqued my interest in working in that crossroads, especially when my first child was born. And he's 13 years old today. And air quality had never impacted me. It had never mattered so much to me as when I finally had that baby in my arms. And at that point, I no longer felt like showing up to protest was getting my voice far enough for the impact I wanted to make on changing the reality that we live and breathe in here as Utahns, particularly in Salt Lake. That's when I started nonprofit work, volunteering, and eventually about a decade ago, co-founded Breathe Utah to work in what then was a vacuum where we had been protesting, a lot of us have been protesting on air quality a long time, so much that the powers that be started to say, okay, we're ready to come to the table, but who are we going to work with? And we formed Breathe Utah to intentionally be a moderate voice on air quality that works with data, science, and would come to the table with policy solutions. And that's where I started to feel like I was finally getting somewhere.
So that's one of your priorities. It has been on the city council. You say it will be as mayor. What can the city do to make a noticeable difference on this issue, particularly as the state and as the city continue to grow?
Let's zoom out from air quality for a moment to the climate change level, because ultimately I think climate change is the number one issue that we are facing as a worldwide community. What do we do about climate change? Now, it's a heavy and daunting conversation for a lot of people, but when it comes to air quality, we can zoom out to that climate change level and talk about our franchise agreement with Rocky Mountain Power. And back in the Becker administration, he started to renegotiate what ended up being the most progressive franchise agreement with a power company anywhere in the country. And that was to say, we're not going to sign a 25-year contract with you anymore. We're going to sign a 5-year agreement where you agree to help us meet our appropriately aggressive climate change goals or carbon reduction. And that's what ended up happening. Jackie Biskupski ended up finalizing that agreement. And that goal at this point is a 2030 goal for carbon neutrality. Rocky Mountain Power has agreed, as we go through that contract every 5 years, to look at how we're doing each year at getting closer and hopefully achieving that goal. We know, though, now that CO2 emissions have surpassed what our expectations were back when that 2032 and then 2030 goal was set. We know we need renewable energy much faster. We need to reduce those carbon emissions faster. So that contract is up in 2020. We begin that negotiation next year, and our next mayor begins to talk with Rocky Mountain Power about how are we going to get that power here faster, and we need it here really by 2023. We know that clearly. So that's at the macro level for Utah, because those coal-fired power plants are not in our Salt Lake Valley, and frankly, those emissions aren't blowing into this valley. So when we zoom down to air quality at the local level, there's a lot we can do. One of those things, as you know, Nicole, vehicles are the number one source of emissions for the time being. In the coming 5 or 6 years, they anticipate buildings will surpass vehicle emissions. But for the meantime, you know, we're doubling our population along the Wasatch Front in the coming decades. We're doubling the amount of vehicles basically on the road, and we must make it easier for people to come in and out and live within Salt Lake City without getting in a single occupant vehicle. We have to make it easier and we have to make it cheaper. So this is where the economy comes in, and we're not only experiencing population growth, but a lot of investment in Salt Lake City. Frankly, I want to see tech ecosystem investment in Salt Lake City. I want to see those businesses start put their roots down here, not on the Silicon Slopes, where there's 6 unicorn companies right now and not a single $500 million tech company here in Salt Lake City. Companies like that, industries like that, who share sustainability goals are also attracted to a city that has a thriving transit system. So when the city can come to play ball with the kind of economies that are going to help us achieve our air quality goals, they're also going to help us be able to afford living in this city easier. We know that the average household spends about 20% of its income on transportation costs. When we make it easier for people to get out of their cars, we're helping clean up the air. We're making it easier to live in this city, though. We're making it cheaper, and we're helping build a community and an economy that helps us go farther faster. There's a lot of other things, from switching out our dirty snowblowers and lawnmowers the way the state has at the state level. It's an incredibly popular program for relatively little money. I want to see Salt Lake City repeat that carrot program, as they call it, at the state level. Whether or not we work with the DAQ to do it or we do it ourselves, it's a way for us to reduce emissions at the most local level of our very own yards. And there's a lot of other initiatives I'd be happy to go into in between those.
Yeah, I noticed that you have a few goals in this area, like expanding bus routes and expanding the Hive Pass discounted UTA passes to businesses and employees in Salt Lake City. I was just wondering, why not push for free public transit in Salt Lake City the way that a couple other candidates did in the primary?
We need to be strategic about our investments, and I think we do get to a free transit system. Absolutely, we do. But for us to pay for that now to UTA for all 200,000 plus of our residents, when really fewer than 100,000 people in Salt Lake City can use transit easily, we're subsidizing something that most of us can't use. So I think it's about turning those levers together. As we crank up usability of our system, we need to be turning down the cost at the same time. Otherwise, we're subsidizing something that people aren't going to be accessing. So we get to the free transit, but I've been on the city council for 6 years. We oversee the budget of the city. I know how tight the money is. And for us to make those kind of investments without it being usable, I think is, frankly, too soon.
So I want to go now to the inland port. You have had a key role in getting that where it is now. But because of your involvement, I think there might be a little bit of this perception out there that you support the inland port or that you're helping the state move that along. Maybe that came after the city council approved, finalized this $28 million tax break for a developer out there. Can you go back, one, and explain what happened there? And two, what are your plans for the inland port if you are elected?
I'm going to go back not to the vote. We'll get to that next. But I'm going to go back farther to the fact and the reality that Salt Lake City has never been asked the question, do you want an inland port? That's never been an opportunity for us to discuss either as a council or a community or a mayor. The question all along, really since late 2016, early 2017, when the property owners north of I-80, which is probably where the port fits, started saying to the state and the city, we're ready to build this. The economy is there, the market forces are there, and we've got the money to do it. And the state and the city, as you know, they've had ideas about a port for decades. The state said to Salt Lake City, if you don't go play ball, as the city is supposed to, and working with property owners, we're going to do it for you. And so at that time, Mayor Biskupski, I think, made a really wise choice, actually, which was to keep the state out of the conversation and work with the property owners to develop a master plan for that area north of I-80, and then ultimately to develop to execute a development agreement, which is a legal contract between property owners and the city to say, as long as you develop according to this plan that we agreed upon, we can set up a process where you can receive tax reimbursement. So it's not a tax break outright. It's a reimbursement for them developing things like streets, street lighting, public utilities. And as long as they do it according to the plan, there's a contract there to ensure they can get a portion of that future tax growth back. So that all happened really under the threat of the state saying, if you don't do this, we're going to do it for you. She executed that final contract right at the beginning of the 2018 legislative session with, I think, eyes wide open that if we don't do this, we knew legislation was coming. Well, sure enough, she signs that contract in January. Come March of that same legislative session, they pass the biggest abomination the state has ever passed against any city. And that took all of our 100% of our taxing, our future tax revenue, and an ability to override our land use decisions for a quarter of our city. Now, the governor signed it into law, although he admitted it was a bad deal for the city, and promised that he'd come to negotiate with Mayor Biskupski and come up with some amended version for a special session. Well, the short story is they tried to negotiate. She became frustrated with the negotiation and walked away from it. And the state at that point said, it's in law. If you don't want to come and negotiate with us, we're going to roll ahead with this taking, essentially. They didn't need us. And that's when the city council decided unanimously to go back and try to fight for some improvements for the city, for our residents, for our taxpayers. The kind of things that they were ready to do and that they were entitled to do through law were things like demand police service, water, sewer, streets, infrastructure out there that, as by the state constitution, we're required to provide as a city, but all of us would have been paying for it, and they wouldn't have had to pay for anything. In addition to that, all of the new tax revenue that could be created from that undeveloped land being developed, they were going to sweep all of that for themselves. The ability that they had, in addition to override the land use decisions, were things like, I can promise you from all of my experience in Salt Lake City that if today a private property owner over there came to the city and said, I know the zoning doesn't allow for me to put a stockyard or a smelter out there, Salt Lake City's going to tell them no. They're going to tell them no, maybe even with some colorful language in front of it. There's no way that's going to happen. But today, that very same property owner who got a no from the city could take their denial to the Inland Port Authority Board and say, look, here's how it's going to serve your inland port concept. Here's the economics of it that I anticipate. And they can override our land use decisions. We've never experienced, no city in the state's ever experienced something like that. So that's why it was important for us to stay at the conversation with those private property owners, because up there, the Inland Port Authority doesn't have any jurisdiction, because of that contract that Mayor Biskupski signed that protected it before they could act. And so fast forward to a few weeks ago when some of those property owners said, now we're ready to take one of the first steps that we signed in the contract and said made it legal for us to request that reimbursement. If the city council would have voted no, or if we would have delayed it farther than the 60 days from their time of their application, we could have been found in breach of contract. And I don't even think that they would have taken the time to go to the Third District Court and sue us for violating our contract, because the Inland Port Authority already drew all of that land into their boundaries in anticipation of us losing our seat at the table. I will not stand for Salt Lake City to lose another 7,000 acres to the Inland Port Authority. And I don't know that people quite understand the reality we were faced with. And now Mayor Biskupski and the City Council have disagreed on a lot of the approaches to the Inland Port situation, but this is one we did not disagree on. She forwarded that recommendation to us as the board of the RDA for us to approve that application. And the City Council, acting as the RDA, unanimously approved it. And I think what that should mean to you as the voters is that all 8 representatives of Salt Lake City although we've disagreed on many pieces, agree that this was the best choice to keep Salt Lake City at the table and prevent the state from taking over 7,000 acres, 4,000 of which are natural buffer area that they could eliminate and allow development to happen on. We can't let that happen. So that's, too long, but a nutshell version of a very complex issue, which is ongoing. I didn't answer the last part of your question, which is what will we do going forward?
Right.
They've talked about, they being the legislature, have talked about the probability of there being legislation every year on the inland port as it develops. It is a pretty Herculean economic idea, and they anticipate needing to adjust it all of the time. In the 6 years I've been in the city council, I've been on the legislative subcommittee for most of those years, and I was chair of the council last year when all of this started. And I can tell you every time that the can of worms of Salt Lake City is opened by the legislature, we don't know what's going to happen, and it's a really risky endeavor. So going forward, Salt Lake City needs to be anticipating and managing as best as possible every year the legislation that's opened on the Inland Port Authority. I think that the temperament of our mayor and her ability to work with and stand up for her city at the same time is going to greatly determine the outcomes of our city's future with the inland port. We have environmental justice issues in this area. We have one of the most sensitive wetlands and migratory bird pathways in this area. We have worked hard to protect those areas, but it's not enough. We need to be at the table as they make decisions. We need to be there as a business plan is formed and they're deciding how they're going to execute it. So no matter what happens with the litigation, which again and again and again I'll tell you I support, because we've never had a quarter of our city's head on the chopping block, no matter what happens with the litigation, we have to stay at it. We can't just be yelling from City Hall. We have to be there.
So I was going to ask about that litigation. They have said that they hope to have it resolved in the next couple months. There's always the chance that it won't be and that it will drag on for months and months. You say you support continuing that. You also say you want to be at the table leading the city and have a seat at the table with the state. How will pushing that lawsuit affect your ability to negotiate with the state? Would the legislature be able to negotiate in good faith with somebody who's suing them?
So the issues of the lawsuit, the answer, I believe, is absolutely yes. Here's why. The issues of the lawsuit are not about whether or not there should be an inland port. It's about the legality of a majority unelected board, which is the Inland Port Authority, being able to do city functions as is defined by the state constitution. Those two main functions that are taken by the Inland Port Authority are that ability to sweep our tax increment and to override land use decisions. And so those two issues are part of what we attempted to negotiate in that negotiation last year, and they have always been a point of disagreement between myself and leadership at the state. It's absolutely no news to them that Salt Lake City feels that we should constitutionally be allowed and, frankly, entitled to retain those authorities. That's not a surprise, and they've known that all along. At the same time, actually, I think Salt Lake City and the state are in a better position when it's not the city going up there to go fisticuffs with the state during every legislative session trying to get back those authorities. Let's have the courts decide. This is a judicial issue. It is the Constitution that is in question. And if we can have the courts decide on this issue, then we actually are better able to go up on the Hill during the legislative session and work on whatever it is on the table at that time. But this is a constitutional issue that the courts should decide upon.
A lot of people that ran for mayor, a lot of them, obviously it's just you and Luz Escamilla now, but say that they support a green inland port. You support a zero emissions port. Is that possible? Is there anything like that out there? And how do you convince the Republican majority legislature to go for something like that?
Yeah, great question. Well, I'm an environmentalist, so if I were queen for a day, we would not have any development out there, and we would allow the international migratory bird pathway and the wetlands to remain exactly as they are. The reality is that this is private property, and We do not own any of it. And that's another story when it comes to the landfill north of I-80. But in terms of it being a green port, no, there's not a port in the world as clean as our port would have to be. And the have to be is both because we should not for a second accept anything less. And the wonderful hammer that we have, or rather the framework that we have, is that we are in serious non-attainment with the Clean Air Act. And barring our current president's ability to further gut the EPA and the Clean Air Act, we are under the most serious designation in terms of what we can allow and what we can't allow to be developed in this airshed. Now, this entire area that we're talking about is within the serious non-attainment area. And so there's a very real construct that things need to happen in. I don't know that we can predict how clean this port can be, because no one has ever attempted to develop a port that would, frankly, I don't know if there's one that has been developed in a serious non-attainment area. And definitely the technologies are improving all of the time, but we don't know yet. They haven't come up with their business plan yet either. And these are all both reasons to be concerned and big question marks for everyone.
Yeah, we should point out that the inland port is very controversial already, getting protests at every meeting they have, but they're still in these very, very early planning stages, and it will probably be years before anything is out there, right?
We hope so.
The streets and the warehouses that are being built now.
And the city's filed an injunction to hopefully prohibit them from being able to act with any of our taxing dollars in the meantime.
Okay. So I want to switch to homelessness now. It's been kind of a rough year for Salt Lake's homeless shelters. We have three new resource centers coming online. One is open. A second is just a few days away from being able to accept taking people in. And a third in South Salt Lake has had several construction delays now. The road home was supposed to be closed by now, but it is still operating. So this is all a big collaboration between the state, the county, the city, and nonprofits. But what sort of responsibility does the city have in making sure that people have a place to sleep at night, especially when temperatures start dropping? Will there be enough beds when the road home closes? And what do you do if not?
There were a lot of questions in there, and I want to try to answer them all. So if some of them fall through the cracks, let me know. What responsibility does the city have? We are the capital city. We have the greatest concentration of services for individuals experiencing homelessness. And whether they're housed or not, homeless residents are our neighbors, and we need to take care of them. All of that is true. While this is not Salt Lake City's problem on our own, this is a statewide issue for us to work on and solve together. And never before the last couple of years has the state come to the table as much as it has in order to help these homeless resource centers come online. Now, there's been a lot of talk about beds and capacity and comparing the road home to the three new homeless resource centers. I think that we won't get into those weeds today necessarily, but you know that the number of beds in the new shelters or the new resource centers doesn't necessarily match up to the capacity of the road home. And so we've been working on expanding access to housing, so growing our affordable housing, and I hope we'll get to talk about that too. But also helping people stay in housing and helping people get back into it before they have to become homeless or be able to find resources, whether it's their family or their communities, so they don't end up having to be in a shelter. I still, although I'm optimistic about the HRCs that are coming online, I have major concerns, particularly for Salt Lake City, when the road home closes and wintertime comes. I think that it will take some time for people who are experiencing homelessness in that community to transition into the homeless resource centers. I hope that's not true, but we are yet to see. And then there will be a shelter-resistant portion of the population. The work that our social workers with the police department are doing is, we hear it's about 25% successful, which means that they contact individuals day in and day out, and it takes many points of contact before someone may be lured to participate in services. but that's about a 1 in 4 take-up rate. So what do we do with the other 3/4 of that population, generally speaking, who is still on the streets and may not be interested in accessing shelter? This is another part where the city comes to the table. As we work on affordable housing options here in Salt Lake City, we're looking at single-room occupancy houses. And our friend Pamela Atkinson, who works with individuals experiencing homelessness all of the time, tells us that a lot of the people she talked to say, I'm not going to go into a shelter, but if you could get me a room somewhere, a room for me and my dog and a TV and my things, that would be enough. And I don't need to share, I can share a kitchen, I can share a bathroom, but just get me a room. That's an opportunity that the city is looking at, and we're looking at expanding the opportunity for people, for even government, to build single-room occupant housing. So that's one of the ways that we can perhaps address that shelter-resistant population. But I think it is, really, it's becoming one of the number one issues, one of the biggest issues for residents of our city and for people coming in and out of the city. So I'll mention one other thing that I think is the city's opportunity and responsibility when it comes to helping on this issue. That is to be the catalyst to bring together all of those big players in the Salt Lake City realm who really can have an impact because it affects their values. So I'm talking, yes, about the state, I'm talking about the county, but I'm talking about the business community, I'm talking about the universities. It is hard on our economy. It's hard to attract people to work here, to invest here, when they're having to step over so many people just to walk down the street. From a humanitarian perspective to the economy, we need to be working on this issue. It is absolutely the city's responsibility, and we know we can lead out. So I don't want to see us get these 3 homeless resource centers open, the road home closed, and slap our hands and say, great job, we're done, because I'm afraid we are not going to be done. And there is absolutely more work that needs to be done, and we need to be planning for that bridge of how to get there.
We have a couple audience questions on this topic. So one person wants to know, as homeless populations scatter, crime is increasing in new areas, how would you balance maintaining safe communities with providing support to individuals?
This is a great question, and it's one that I've been working on as a councilwoman for 6 years. District 5 that I represent includes the majority of State Street in Salt Lake City, from 9th South to 21st South. It also includes Ballpark area, Liberty Wells, and Liberty Park, and then farther east. These are areas that have, and other areas in the city, have absolutely felt the impacts or the outflux from Operation Rio Grande, from alleyways to parking lots and the parks themselves, public restrooms. We have been experiencing an increase in crime, but also an increase in encampments and people sleeping away from the shelter. I'll tell you that if I were to experience homelessness starting tonight, I would probably choose to be at a park myself, or not at the road home necessarily. And I hear this from other women experiencing homelessness. We have worked from a few years ago in listening to the community. I worked to bring back the bike squad. That was something that we had in Salt Lake City until the recession. It was cut for financial reasons, and I brought it back about 4 years ago, and we have an east side and a west side bike squad. That's been made a better police presence of proactive policing and eyes on the street, and yet here we still are. And so we listened to the community, and they said, we want a pilot park ranger program. We want you to have more of a presence in these big public spaces so that it feels safe for us to go there, so that I can send my kid there to ride her bike around the park with her friends and not be so worried. And just this year, in June, the city council and the mayor administration, we put together a pilot park ranger program, and that'll be growing through the police department, again, through the bike squad, to increase that presence in our communities. We can't lose our parks to a feeling of unsafety and criminal activity, and I'm afraid that we're reaching that crescendo. So it's a long way to answer that I think the answers come from the communities. They come from listening. They come from hearing what the community councils and the neighbors and the local businesses who are living this every single day and who can access their local government. And they have someone to talk to. That's really where my passion has been over the last 6 years of working as a councilwoman and listening to the community and then figuring out how to make it happen at the city level.
Another listener asked, what will be your litmus test for whether the new homeless resource center model is meeting the needs of our city? If you determine that there aren't enough beds in this new model, what will be your plan going forward?
That is a wonderful question that the Shelter of the Homeless Board and the Department of Workforce Service are trying to come up with some measures. So let's say that the homeless resource centers are all capped out, that the two Salt Lake City ones are both at their full occupancy of 200 individuals, and the South Salt Lake shelter is at 300 once they're up and running. And still, we have a great sizable population of people experiencing homelessness on and around our streets in Salt Lake City. We'll still have our social workers reaching out to them with the police department, and we will, I anticipate, not have a change in the uptake. I worry that the wintertime coming will exacerbate that problem and that we'll be dealing with a humanitarian crisis. So before a litmus test can even happen as a mayor, we're going to have freezing temperatures more than likely before January, before the mayoral transition takes place. And Department of Workforce Service and Spencer Cox, our lieutenant governor, I've been speaking with them and expressing, frankly, my concern as a councilwoman that we're going to have a crisis on our hands. They have, well, I should say I'm optimistic that they're coming up with a plan. We don't know yet what that plan is, but I don't want to wait for the litmus test to be that people are freezing and dying on our streets. We need a plan far before that. And in the meantime, if those homeless resource centers are full and people want to access services and are unable to, then we need to be having this conversation with the state and the county about where is the next homeless resource center. It's not going to be in Salt Lake City. It's probably not going to be in South Salt Lake. But this is a statewide issue, and the state needs to be leading this conversation. If there are people wanting services and they cannot access it because the shelters are full, then we need another shelter. That is a real obvious reality that we will be able to measure. If the resource centers are full and no one else wants to get into the shelters and we still have people on the streets, then we need to be finding another way to clean our streets, make them safe, and help people get the services that they need. People need restrooms. They need help with everything from laundry and a safe place to be and a library sometimes to rest in. So where we go from there, we'll be needing to work with our service providers, our county, and our state partners. But I think there's a few different pathways that may pan out.
So climate change and air quality, the inland port, homelessness, all very big pressing issues, all made worse, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, by the fact that the state is growing at a very rapid rate. Our population is going to double on the Wasatch Front in the next 20 years, maybe. So I think in Salt Lake City, this population growth is most noticeable right now, maybe in Sugar House, lots of development there. The downtown seems to be expanding quite a bit. Apartment buildings have been shooting up here on 4th South for the past few years. How do you plan to balance growth and a need for housing, especially affordable housing, with the city's residential areas? There's been this kind of tug of war over the past few years over that issue, it seems like.
I think at first I want to push back just a little bit on the beginning of your question, which was, could these issues be exacerbated by the growth that we're experiencing? Mm-hmm. And I would argue the contrary. I think that with the economic growth and opportunity that we are experiencing and that we hope continues in the right ways for our city, that is an incredible motivator for more of the community, and I'm talking about the business community, all the way up to the state, even those universities again, to say, no, we've got a lot at stake here, and we really want this to be the kind of community that we hope for, that we want our kids to be able to grow up in, that we want it to be a safe place that's attractive and serves everyone. And so I think that we can actually use that growth to help us address these issues. Now, when it comes to our neighborhood, Salt Lake City is part of what makes us so unique on the national level, as a capital city especially, is our many intact historic neighborhoods. What a unique and incredible asset we have, from the ballpark neighborhood on West Temple up to the avenues on the west side of our city, Rose Park, all the way up to St. Mary's area and some of those neighborhoods on the East Bench. They are very integral and part of the characteristic of this city. And yes, they are threatened with growth. When we look at areas like Sugar House in particular, that was a redevelopment project area that the city undertook. It took about 27 years. We just retired it a couple of years ago. And although I recognize and I share in a lot of the frustration about the transportation max, the transportation difficulties in that area that I don't believe have grown to accommodate the density of population that we've put there, I think it's important to recognize that we saw this growth coming decades ago. And Salt Lake City, as the redevelopment agency, as we do often, went to the community and said, we're growing. How we grow matters to us. Would we rather grow along 11th East, 9th East, 6th East, and let apartment buildings replace homes that are there today and spread that density out? Or would we rather concentrate that density and create what has come to be a second downtown today? And it was a deliberate and intentional decision those decades ago to concentrate that growth and preserve our neighborhoods in a more significant way. So fast forward 30 years into the future, even a little bit beyond that today, and Sugar House is tall, it is dense, it is still growing taller, and yet there are, for the most part, quite intact neighborhoods right next door to it. And I think as we grow into the future, we have to continue having these conversations with the neighborhoods and the communities. What do we want to grow like? Growth is not changing, and the majority of that growth is our own kids. So how do we want to grow as a community? And each and every project area is different. It should be, but it's about having those conversations at the neighborhood level and making those decisions together.
We have a lot of audience questions on this topic.
I'll try to be more brief.
It's on a lot of people's minds. So someone asked, would you be open to designating any streets to only alternative modes of transportation, such as bicycles, scooters, buses, etc., to get people out of cars?
I would be open to having those conversations. I think that our downtown core, in particular, on Main Street, where we have tracks, is an interesting place for us to consider that kind of a closed-to-vehicle traffic conversation. But that's a conversation that we need to be having with the Chamber and the Downtown Alliance and the businesses in that area. At the same time, I recognize that we don't have a single street like that in this city, and that would be a bold maneuver for Salt Lake City to close a street like that. I have heard, as a councilwoman, this is my third race, of course my first one for mayor, but I've run in Salt Lake City many times before, or several times before, and this is something that comes up every time. People are interested in seeing that kind of a pedestrian environment in Salt Lake City, and I think it's a conversation we could have.
Next, what steps will you take as mayor or a council member to mitigate the environmental impact of a growing population?
Oh boy, that is a good one. Let's talk about water in particular. I know that there are a lot of concerns when we talk about the environment, not just about air quality and climate change, but about water and the fact that we're in a desert. Excuse me. And there's a lot of demands on our watershed and, frankly, threats to it, as Salt Lake City owns so much of the watershed outside of our city. And that's another conversation that I'd be happy to have. But when we concentrate people in, especially in newer developments, the beauty of new development today and a lot of the fixtures from faucets to water heaters and the appliances that go into those developments are more efficient than in my old house in my neighborhood. We actually get more efficiency by concentrating people in most instances than we do by continuing with single family home development or sprawl. And in Salt Lake City, we know it's just about a little bit over 60% of the water we use goes onto our lawns. It's all used outside of the home. And so a little less than 40% is actually used for our drinking water and inside of the houses. So you think about it, an apartment complex. Today we have some pretty clear landscaping guidelines as a city about the kind of xeriscaping and native plantings that we encourage and we want to see happen. But it's a lot less lawn, so you're eliminating that 60% of the outside watering needs when you concentrate people in those dense type of housing, and the inside use that we use is more efficient. So apartments isn't the answer, but I'll tell you that as we're growing, that's the majority of the housing types that we're seeing grow in Salt Lake City is multifamily. And so that actually the way we're growing compared to other cities along the Wasatch Front is some of the most conservative when it comes to water use.
What are your plans to utilize or revitalize the West Side?
Salt Lake City developed a West Side Master Plan just a few years ago when I was on the council, and we have begun to implement the West Side Master Plan with improvements to 9th West, pedestrian scale bike lanes, bulb outs to make it easier and more safe to cross the street. But to, even still today, it's really hard to get a cup of coffee on the West Side. It's hard to find daycare. You can't really meet me for a breakfast burrito over at 9th and 9th West. And those kind of daily access to the economy, access to the kind of infrastructure that attracts investment is still woefully inadequate. So we've developed a 9-line master plan, which is another kind of a nerdy city thing that's intended to attract the kind of development and investment in the West Side that makes it more livable. But it, beside improving the infrastructure and the economics of the West Side itself, we need to talk about access to the rest of the city. And much of our West Side is isolated by freeways and rail lines. And literally, access is a real issue. As you know, if you've ever needed to commute east to west, you might get stopped by a train and it could stop you for 3 minutes or 17 minutes. It makes it really hard to get to work on time when you have to face that. And so when we talk about access, our transit system is another way that we can improve livability on the west side of our city. We also know that a lot of our, actually the majority of the kids in Salt Lake City per capita live on the west side of Salt Lake City. And many of those young students go to East High School up on 13th East. And so it was really important that we installed the 9-line circulator bus, I'm sorry, the 9th South circulator bus, which has been online for about a month now. And it runs 7 days a week, about every 15 minutes most of those days. And it connects the west side to the east side. It doesn't go into Holiday on the east side. It doesn't end up in Kearns on the west side. It just stays in Salt Lake City going back and forth. And this is an investment we made together when we did the Funding Our Future conversation last year, and residents said loud and clear, we want transit service to be better here in Salt Lake City. So connecting our west side and our east side is another one of the ways that we can improve. But I'll tell you also that we need to increase representation on our boards and commissions and access to City Hall itself. City Hall needs to keep leaving City Hall and going into the community to listen, not requiring people to come to us. And then even the way we approach our boards and commissions, which are volunteer and make a lot of important decisions and recommendations in our city, we should be talking about childcare stipends. If you can't afford to come serve on a board or commission because you have to pay $12 for a babysitter and you're going to be gone 4 hours, it is very, very little money for Salt Lake City to consider giving someone a childcare stipend or a meal stipend or a lift reimbursement. If you have to take a bus there and it's going to take you 50 minutes and you're going to be there so late, there's no bus going back, we're going to pay for that. How do we eliminate those barriers that get more diversity of our community represented in the decisions that our boards and our commissions and all of these forms of government are taking? There's a lot of things we can do.
One more West Side question. This person wants to know, how do you feel about the racist move to cut UTA lines from the west side of Salt Lake City?
Well, that's a good question for a UTA board member. I can't comment on whether that's racist or not, and I don't know what motivated the elimination of bus lines on the west side. I do know that the city council intentionally implemented these east-west connectors to better connect the west and east sides of our city, and we are paying UTA to run those routes. They don't get to decide to cut those routes. They don't get to decide when they run. We're telling them when they can run, and then we're telling them where they need to go. And that was intentionally done to increase geographic access in our city for our residents. So I know what Salt Lake City's priorities are. I can't speak for UTA's.
One more question. What is your plan for the closed storefronts that line some city streets, specifically they listed 4th South, 9th West, Indiana Avenue?
Yeah, so the Nine Line project area that I mentioned a minute ago, you should go look at it. In City Hall, we affectionately call it the area formerly known as Prince, because if you'll recall that the Prince, the musician, had a symbol, and that's what the Nine Line project area looks like. And it incorporates most of 9th South, and the intention is really to provide funding, whether it's in the form of land discounts, low-interest loans, or grant programs for residents and businesses and developers in that area to develop and open up those storefronts to bring the kind of businesses in to help that community thrive. And I want you to know that this is a plan that was developed with that community. It's not that the Sugar House area plan is picked up and plopped down in Glendale. It's that we work with that community to say, what do you need here? What do you want? And then we're going to invest to make sure that it happens. So city can use its investments. We have some really strategic tools, from the redevelopment agency to housing and neighborhood development, to intentionally help the kind of infrastructure, business, services happen in a neighborhood. So I look forward to that. It's almost available. City's finished our parts. We're just waiting for the school district and the county to approve on their ends.
One more question about apartments. There are thousands of new apartments in Salt Lake City. There are tens of thousands of new residents. How will all of this affect property taxes in the city?
Property taxes have mostly been rising, as you all know. I won't make everybody raise their hands if they've had their property taxes go up, but I would guess it's most everyone. And the apartments, of course, as we raise values of any parcel of property, if that's building many more apartments or it's improving your own home, property taxes get reevaluated by the county and then assessed. And all of us, whether you pay it as a renter through a portion of your rent, or you pay it directly as a homeowner or as a business owner, you know what I'm talking about. Now, part of the risk is that we start to price people out of their own homes. And this is particularly threatening to people on a fixed income. And we in Salt Lake City government, we want Salt Lake City to be a place where the whole spectrum of age can be here and age in place. So on the city council, we talked about accessory dwelling units, which are, I wish we would have called the cabana ordinance, because it would make a lot more sense. Accessory dwelling units are kind of the mother-in-law concept, whether it's in your basement or your attic or it's a separate building. We were hearing from residents, truly from the East Bench to the westernmost residential areas of our city, saying, I'm on a fixed income or I'm looking at retirement, and my property tax keeps going up year over year, and I don't know how I'm going to be able to afford to stay in my home that I've worked my whole life to enjoy retirement in. And people have said, people again across the city said, if I could use the equity I have in my home to build this apartment or this cabana and be able to select who lives in there, and that person could help me do everything from shovel the sidewalks to keep the eyes on the property. Some people even said to me, I'm going to move into that accessory dwelling unit and I'm going to rent my house. But either way, the owner stays on the property and they're able to create a stream of income for themselves that helps them to age in place. Now, this is not affordable housing. These units would be, they're fairly expensive to construct, and there's a lot of guidelines, or rather regulations about how they're done, but that's a way that we allow affordability for people to be able to age in place. It's important to me that as my mother ages, and hopefully as I get to age in this city, I can stay here as long as I want to. And that's one of the ways that we get at that affordability across an age spectrum.
What specifically would you do, and you've mentioned this, to attract tech companies to to Salt Lake City or relocate to downtown?
We don't have to invent the wheel on this one at all. There are cities all over the country working intentionally with the universities and the business community to set a vision for a tech ecosystem. And as you know, the universities, the business community, and government have different assets to bring to that table, different incentives. But seldom do we come together, especially proactively. We may come together reactively to deal with a complex issue like homeless crisis, but let's come together proactively to create that vision and then execute it. I was just talking to some people in the audience earlier. We have 6 unicorn companies between Draper and Lehigh. That's $500 million tech companies. That number's growing, too. There's not a single unicorn company in Salt Lake City. That's ridiculous. And I know a part of the reason it's ridiculous is a lot of their good talent lives here in the city. They don't want to live in South Jordan and Draper. They live in Salt Lake City, and they commute out every day. This is the fastest growing and the highest paid industry in the state. It supports 1 in 7 jobs in this state. We need this industry here. Some of their values are highly reflective of Salt Lake City values, values around diversity and sustainability and environmental sustainability. This is the kind of business we need in Salt Lake City. We have a university that's now a part of the Pac-12. They've got a bottom line to deliver on, too. And it helps entities from the state to the business community downtown to the University of Utah to have the kind of talent live, work, and play in this city that they can recruit their next talent, that they can recruit investors. And when we grow our tax base strategically, because make no mistake, we are growing for sure. But let's be more intentional about how we grow so that we grow our tax base and we're better able to get more buses in this city faster. We're better able to address our air quality. And we're better able to address really a climate future that is carbon neutral for Salt Lake City. And we have to get aggressive about that.
On the flip side of that, not unicorns, small businesses, what will your administration do to address the difficulty of doing business as a small business in Salt Lake City? And why are small businesses forgotten when it comes to tax incentives and rebates?
Great questions. And Salt Lake City's small business neighborhoods and that presence is, I think, what draws so many of us to live here in Salt Lake City. My neighborhood is the 9th and 9th neighborhood, and if you've been up there lately, you know that 9th South is heavily under construction, and some of my favorite businesses are suffering right now because of access issues and just the perception that they might not be open because of construction. This is a perfect example of why, in my administration, I will be setting aside a portion of the capital projects that we do. We're talking about 0.5% to 1% of a total project cost to be set aside to support the small businesses that are impacted by that construction. So let me put it back to the 9th South example. If Salt Lake City had set that money aside, it's about a $3.5 million project that we're working on there. That would be really pennies compared to the size of the project, but it would allow those small businesses to be able to have sandwich boards printed to say, we're open, parking this way, come on in. One of the businesses in that area, they paid about $80 to have that sandwich board made, and unfortunately, one of the dump trucks backed over it and smashed it. And when the business owner called Salt Lake City and said, look what happened, and I'm just trying to get by here, the city said, I'm sorry, we don't have any money to help you replace that sign. That is unacceptable. And I say it's unacceptable because I know we're doing that project to improve that area and support those local businesses. But if we kill those businesses in the process, we are missing the ball. It doesn't take a lot for us to work in synchronicity with those businesses and support them with such a small investment to keep them afloat. This is something that the city of St. Louis, or rather St. Paul, and Minneapolis have undertaken, and they have a much more robust program that I'm looking into. But we need small businesses to be at the top of mind when we are doing projects in this city, but also in the mayor's cabinet. So I will be looking at a small business czar for Salt Lake City who will be able to integrate and work with economic development, our streets department, public utilities, and all the ways that we end up impacting small businesses.
Great. What are your plans to work with educators to reduce class sizes, improve teacher retention, and increase support staff to create safer schools?
These are really important questions, and I will be honest with you that Salt Lake City mayor doesn't have a voting role on the school board. even though it's really attractive to candidates, including myself, to talk about all the things we would love to do to fix education, we need to be realistic about what kind of control or influence we actually have. So the control part, we don't have. We don't have control over their budget. We don't really impact their budget except for our own economic growth. They get to capture a portion of that. And we don't have a voting role. But the influence part is highly underutilized. The mayor of Salt Lake City does have an ex officio role on the school board. And I'll tell you, at least for the last 12 years, it is totally underutilized. Our mayor doesn't participate in the school board meetings to any great extent. And there is a conversation for us to have there. The safety I'll get to in just a moment. I want to tell you one important piece. The school district has looked and had an audit done recently, or a study, that shows they're anticipating about an 8,000 student decline in Salt Lake City schools in the coming years. They've talked about, and it's been proposed, to close several elementary schools. This has a big impact, you know, on just even the psyche of those neighborhoods, let alone the services to families. So this is a concern. Even today, a lot of our elementary schools and other schools are below capacity, so they have room in those schools. At the same time, Salt Lake City runs Youth City programming. And if you don't know, that's a high-quality, really affordable after-school and summer programming run through the city. It's not run at any of the schools. It's run at Liberty Park, at one of our buildings, and Sorenson Unity Center, and a couple of other places. Highly in-demand, waiting list. Affordable, accessible. Big gap in our schools. Can you see where I'm going with this? Salt Lake City and the school district need to come together and talk about, if it's a priority for Salt Lake City, and I know it is, and it's a priority of mine, that we make Salt Lake City a livable place for families. Families are moving out, and we see it by our school numbers. We want families to be able to live here. But taking care of your kids is expensive. So if the schools have the infrastructure for us to operate Youth City in, and we have families waiting in line to pay for their kids to participate in Youth City, there's a real conversation for us to have about coming together. School safety is it's a frightful thing at this point. I have three kids. I have a son at West High School, another child in elementary school, and a daughter in preschool, and my son at West, you know, texted me from lockdown 2 weeks ago, "Mom, I'm okay. There's a gunman in the school, and I was on a flight." And long story short, I couldn't reply until we got into the airport. And there is no bigger fear I've ever felt. And I know that we're not alone. In Utah, of course, across the country, unfortunately across the world, these threats are happening. But we know that the student to counselor ratio right now is atrocious. It is hundreds of kids. I've heard that it's north of 450 kids per counselor at my son's high school. And there may be a way for Salt Lake City to invest in access to mental health providers, to school counselors, and reduce that ratio so that students in need can have someone to talk to if they need to. I shared once at an earlier forum that my father passed away when I was about almost 14 years old, and I went to a school counselor, and I'm grateful for that person, Mr. Foley, if you're out there in Salt Lake City listening. Thank you for being there for me where that ratio was much lower. And if I needed to pop in, he could make himself available to talk to me. That is not a luxury that most kids in our public schools today have. And growing up is hard. Kids need somebody to talk to. And if Salt Lake City can help make that more accessible, then that's a conversation I want to have as our next mayor.
My last question is, what do you hope Salt Lake City looks like 4 years from now? It's not that far away, but what areas do you hope to make a difference on?
4 years from now will be 2023, and I hope that we're celebrating 100% renewable energy coming into our city that year. I hope that if we're sitting here on this stage, that 90% of you got here by public transit. And I hope that even if you came here on a Lyft ride, that the city was subsidizing you getting to the bus stop or getting from your home to the bus stop with a Lyft ride also. Salt Lake City should also have the kind of economic and cultural vibrancy surrounding us, that if you want to go get a bite to eat or have a drink with some friends after this, that you feel safe walking there in the dark now that the sun has gone down. I could see a future in 4 years or less where our downtown ambassador program, if you've seen those folks in yellow shirts in the downtown core, we need to expand that presence in our downtown area. They provide services to people in need. They provide directions to tourists on the street. They're a set of eyes on the street that's connected to the police department if they need to be, but they aren't police officers, because we know not everyone feels more safe with more officers on our streets. I want Salt Lake City to be a place where you can take a deep breath of clean air in January, and where our legislature is working with us, where the county is working with us, and where our partners from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to Larry H. Miller Corporation and others who have events with tickets in the downtown area have worked with us to create a Salt Lake City where any ticket to an event in Salt Lake City, whether it's the Eccles Theater, Rose Wagner, to General Conference, or anything in between, is your transit pass to get there. Even if you're coming from Farmington or Spanish Fork, the University of Utah is already doing it. One of the trustees was sitting back there a moment ago. The University of Utah, whether you have a gymnastics ticket or a basketball ticket, it's your transit pass. Every ticket in Salt Lake City should be that for you too. We can go far. There is a lot of investment and momentum here. And if we have a mayor who knows not only how Salt Lake City works and how the financing can work and how our taxpayers don't have to be the only thing growing this city, but also knows how to work with others, has a temperament that can stay at the conversation and not take it personally, even when it stinks, we can get more as a city. And I know that I believe that I have that kind of expertise and energy to take us there.
Erin Mendenhall represents District 5 on the Salt Lake City Council and is running for mayor. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Erin.
Thanks, Nicole.